Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening. This is L.A. Steele and Lila. And,
what are you looking for?
Yeah, no, I was waiting for you to say something. And tonight we have a pre-recorded interview with attorney Douglas Caddy, who was the attorney for the Watergate 7 and E. Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy and the guys who broke in at the Watergate Hotel back in 1972. We also have an interview, same interview, on the conference call with Robert Merritt, who was the police informant who notified the D.C. police 2 weeks prior to the Watergate break-in that there would be a break-in. And that's where the intrigue begins. And they co-authored a new book put out by Trine, their publishers. And it'll be on ebook coming out on the September 8th of this month. And that's the release date. And hardcover will be following that. But I think you're going to be really impressed with the interview. What do you think, Lila?
Yeah.
It was very good, huh?
Excellent.
And I think what we're going to do is that we'll just go into the interview and
And then
we'll come back right after, or I'll come back after and talk a little bit about it and possibly read a little bit of news. Does that sound good?
Why are you doing it that way?
Well, only because it's about a 45-minute interview.
Okay.
And so I wanted to make sure that there's enough time for the whole thing to be covered.
Okay.
Live.
Yeah, it was a little bit longer than our typical interviews.
Yeah.
Which generally are only a half hour.
Right. And this one's about 45, 50 minutes. So I wanted to make sure there was plenty of time to cover that.
Okay. Well, why don't you put it right on?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So just give me 1 second here. I had it queued up, and I will. This interview starts off a little bit, unfortunately, there was just a short amount of time, a minute or so that was cut off but at the beginning, but we are speaking with Robert Merritt again and Douglas Caddy. And this part, we start with Robert Merritt as we discuss his history and his involvement. And
I hope you won't be too shocked. He's kind of graphic.
It's quite amazing. Yeah, it's an interesting interview, and we hope that you
appreciate it.
You'll appreciate it. Yeah. So here we go.
Collect political intelligence, and that was the role that I was to play.
Mm-hmm. So who was he working for?
That is a million-dollar question. Carl Chaffee was a police officer with Metropolitan Police Department, but
mm-hmm.
he was also working for the CIA, military intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
He worked for many various agencies. He was freelancing a lot of different agencies. His total background, I guess, even today, would be completely mysterious. Carl Chaffee was even known internationally with some incidents. If you would search his background, you see on the computer that he has a very interesting background.
He
was in the military himself. He had, was in the intelligence field. He also had gone to the Ben Hill Farm in Virginia, which was a training farm for eavesdropping, wiretapping, and he taught me a lot of the techniques myself. Under his orders from him, the FBI and other officials in the D.C. Police Department, I was asked to not only to infiltrate these groups, but to sabotage them, to break into different institutions, to steal mail, plant bugs, plant drugs. One of the main targets being the Institute for Policy Studies, which I had burglarized on a couple of occasions for them, had stolen their mail, turned it over to the FBI. I had infiltrated over several hundred different organizations and over several thousand private citizens.
You're a busy guy.
He's
very busy. Yeah.
I only lived 2 blocks from DuPont Circle at 2122 P Street Northwest, which is exactly 2 blocks from the circle. And Doug Caddy, who's on the line, was lived at 2121 Peachtree, right across the street from me. But the street between Doug and I was like a railroad track. I was on the poor and cultured side, and Doug was with the White House and more affluent influence side.
Mm-hmm. So how did the this meeting with Doug? Now maybe Doug can ask. But how did you meet him? You were told to meet him, and you were actually even told to assassinate him. According to this, how did that come about? And
why didn't you?
And why didn't you?
Because you seem to have done all these other things.
If you don't mind, I think that question is maybe a little premature. I think that before I can explain it to you, I have to tell you that on May the 31st, a good friend of mine who was a drag queen, his real name was James Reed, his a.k.a. Rita Reed, drag name, was working as a phone operator for the Columbia Plaza Apartments on the switchboard. And Rita and I was extremely good friends. And on June the 1st, 1972, Rita came to my home, asked me to take a walk with her, and she informed me that she had overheard conversations on a certain line that there was people who was going to overthrow the presidency, and she knew about the Watergate break-in. And she pleaded with me not to divulge this information. And on May the 2nd, I attempted to... I think it was the same day or following day. I attempted to give that information to Lieutenant Dixie Gildon, who was working actually as my handler for the Metropolitan Police. I was working actually for several people, but Carl Schaffler was my main handler, if you want to say that. He was also my roommate. He was also my secret lover as well for the past couple of years prior to Watergate. Dixie was too busy to talk to me that day, so I informed Carl Schaffler about it, and he was stunned by the information because it was only a few months prior to this, in October of 1971, I had purchased some bombs through Rita from the American Nazi Party, which turned out that these bombs were sterile devices that was used by the CIA. Anyways, there was never no arrest ever made on Rita for this, but there was a lot of intelligence behind it, and Rita told me that the Columbia Plaza Apartments was flooding with intelligence agents of all types after she had sold me those bombs. But anyway, she informed me about the plan to break into the Watergate, and I broke that confidence and told Carl Schaffler about it when I could not get through to Dixie Gildon. And Carl told me that he would keep it in strictest of confidence. Nothing would ever happen to Rita. To make a long story short, Rita Reed completely disappeared from the face of the earth after I gave that information to him, never to be seen again. But Carl Schaffler had taken that information, and that following evening, he came back to my home with a CIA agent, retired agent, by the name of William Sullivan, and another agent from the military, with a name that I don't recall at the moment, and asked me to repeat the whole conversation that Rita had divulged to me about the break-in that was planned for actually June the 18th. And Carl came back the following day, and he told me, he said the information was correct, right on the money. And again, to shorten the story, he said he was going to move the date up to June the 17th, which happened to be his birthday. He wanted to give himself a birthday present since it was the Watergate break-in ahead on the Democratic National Committee headquarters.
Right.
And on June the 17th, Carl had staked out. He had worked overtime that evening. He was supposed to leave, I think, around 5, 6 o'clock that evening to go home to Pennsylvania to be with his wife and his family because it was his birthday. He had a long drive ahead of him, but instead he voluntarily stayed over and worked. And he parked a car about a block and a half or so from the Watergate and was apparently waiting for the phone call to come in that the break-in was about to happen, which it did. And Carl was the arresting officer of the Watergate burglars. When that happened, it was, I think, on June the 20th, Carl came to me with Sergeant Paul Leeper and told me that they had an assignment for me. And they asked me if I knew Douglas Caddy, who lived across the street from me. Said he was the attorney for the Watergate burglars. They wanted me to get acquainted with him on an intimate basis. And I said, what do you mean intimate? And I said, because the picture they showed me had no indication to me that Doug was gay, but they told me that he was, that they had had photographs of him in New York City, and they had profiled him, and they knew that, that he was secretly gay. And I refused, declined to take the assignment because I didn't feel right about it. I mean, I thought that this man, you know, is a closeted gay who is a very prominent attorney working for the White House, working for a company that was affiliated with the CIA, which Doug can explain that himself. But the assignment was to have an intimate affair with him and to, a sexual affair that I was supposed to, without being graphic, I was supposed to insert a suppository during the sexual affair, and the suppository would have caused death within a matter of seconds. And if that had failed, I was given two pills that for me to take myself, which I was informed would only make me nauseated and sick, to give me an opportunity to leave out while he was apparently dying. Or if the assignment had failed, I should say.
Well, you had done a lot of things. That were illegal, and I'm sure done compromised people before. But was this something that you drew the line at, murdering someone?
I'm sorry, I couldn't
name it. She asked, was this where you drew the line? You had been asked to do a number of illegal things or dangerous things.
Actually, I had drawn the line right before the Watergate had happened, because my mother had died on April the 11th of 1972, and I had asked the FBI to advance me money to go to West Virginia to be with my mother, and they refused, stating that the federal government had invested too much money into me and training me, and that I was working on the assignment with the weathermen and also the assignment of the Institute for Policy Studies, and that they said I was just too, that the time was just not right. I mean, how could I excuse my mother from dying on such a date to inconvenience the Bureau? I'll never know. But anyways, when they took that attitude, and plus some of the assignments they were giving me and destroying friends of mine, of planting drugs, bugs, having them falsely arrested, I was the first one in a demonstration to throw a rock at a cop or to cause, you know, literally hundreds of people to be arrested, which was a case in Watergate. In fact, there was over 10,000 people, I believe, was a correct number, that was arrested and placed in a ball stadium somewhere. And to be very honest with you, there was only two CIs, and I was the number one CI that they counted on, not only the police, but the feds as well. My information was extremely good. I worked 16, 18 hours a day. I lived only a couple blocks from the circle.
Now, were they paying you cash advances, or what? How were they paying you?
I made a fantastic salary. I made $50 a week plus expenses, and you know, I got to the point where I was so desperate for money that I would sometimes falsify my expense account by adding an extra 10 cents for a phone call.
My God, $50 a week is all they paid you?
That's all I received, yes. Remember, I was doing a very patriotic thing for my country.
I think I would have told them to shove it up their behinds at that point. I mean, this is criminal, a way to treat you. I mean, it was unbelievable that you would go that route. You know, that you'd allow it. I mean, you were in a position.
You were being abused too.
Yeah, you could have asked for $50,000 a week. They would have paid you.
Well, they did offer $10,000 for me to have sex with Doug Caddy.
Oh, that was a big deal.
And
yeah,
then they raised it to $25,000 after that, and then it went up to almost $100,000 again. And every time I declined, I refused. I felt that if I had sex with Doug Caddy and accomplished what they had wanted, that I would have been killed.
Oh, yeah. before they paid you off, sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this man was, I mean, an attorney working, you know, directly, indirectly for the White House with the Mullen Company, and, and which was a CIA front. Like I said, I'd prefer for Doug to go into that.
Yeah, I think we will get
into the conversation here very shortly. But there's one more question I had for you before, and that is the... you became a fugitive for 18 years. Now, how did you become that, and how did you survive in, through that period?
Well, I'll quickly try to go through that. I know that we don't have much time on.
No, we've got an extended time period here tonight, so that's okay.
After Watergate was over with, I was asked by Carl to relocate from that area because there was too much press. It was international press around the world. And he was gaining all this fame, which he was gloating in his glory. And I knew that actually the fame that sort of belonged to me in a way, because if it had not been for me, there wouldn't have been no Watergate. It would have been just perhaps another burglary if it was ever noted whatsoever, and I kind of doubt it.
Right.
They only went in there for the purpose of not stealing typewriters, but they went in for the purpose of planting bugs and to remove certain bugs that they had or to correct the ones. But anyway, I moved out of the area, and... I was living on 17th and Arlington Northwest for a while, and Lieutenant Dixie Gildon came to my home. This was like in, I think, August or September of 1972, and she had come to me that day in uniform, and Dixie had always come to me, you know, with hugs and kisses and that sort of thing. That particular day she came to my home, she immediately went over to my TV and turned it off, and instead of giving me a hug, she sort of pushed back a little bit, said she had a cold, and then I noticed that she had a bulge in the back of her uniform that was sticking out a little bit, and I was very familiar with the body war at the time, which was antique compared to what they do today.
Right.
But anyway, she had pleaded with me to give her all the information that I had concerning the break-in and as cross-officer involvement, which I was going to, but then when I noticed that she was taping me, I backed off. I lost all confidence in her. And when we left her home, she asked me to walk her to her car, and when I did, we were photographed, obviously, by a police photographer standing on the corner. And it was a few days after that, I started getting very ill. A friend of mine came in, and he said that he noticed something strange in the air in the room. And again, to make another long story short, I called the gas company because the flame on my hot water tank was burning yellow. And when he checked, the man from the gas company checked the tank, he took the flue down, and it was stuffed full of rags, bricks, and rocks, and the flue was leading through the chimney, and the chimney led to my fireplace in my bedroom.
Oh, wow.
Only within a day or two more, he says, I would have been dead from carbon monoxide.
Poisoning.
That was one of the attempts. There was an attempt before, not actually an attempt, but a scary thing where they had actually, one night when I was out near DuPont Circle, a couple of detectives got out of the car, or maybe it was FBI agents, I believe, and they shot bullets over top of my head right at DuPont Circle on Connecticut Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And but I was so close to them that they really wanted me dead that night. They could have done so. But the carbon monoxide thing was the first real attempt.
So why do you think they didn't kill you?
The first time?
No, the second time, like when they knew you weren't.
But the second time is because I discovered the flu. If I had not found that carbon monoxide coming in, I would have been dead. Now that fireplace into my...
No, but you said they could have shot you easily.
Yeah, the first time. That was the first time.
Oh, that was the first time. Oh.
I think that was just a scare tactic.
Right, right.
I mean, I was very timid, very shy. I was sort of looking at myself like a Mark Twain type of bear for the hillbilly from West Virginia.
Yeah.
And they thought that because I was gay, I was easily intimidated, I guess, but...
Well, of course, those were different times.
Oh, absolutely.
Than now.
Different times, yes. Those were very homophobic times.
Mm-hmm.
You could not mention the word gay. I was involved in the Gay Liberation Front that passed out pamphlets in front of the Justice Department to the employees when they got off work one day, and the pamphlet said, I am gay, or you want to.
Mm.
Of course, they got very offended by that.
But anyway, So how did you, again, how did you survive as a fugitive?
I will go forward as fast as I can.
Okay. Then we'll bring up Doug here so he can jump in.
After I left R Street, I moved to 18th and Columbia Road Northwest, where I was working for, for Buster Riggin. I gave him a free apartment over top of his shop. That was an FBI police assignment. They wanted me to spy on Buster Riggin because he was a pimp with John Dean's wife, who was a madam at the Watergate.
Wait a minute. John Dean's wife was a madam?
She was a prostitute.
John Dean's wife was a prostitute?
That's correct, yes.
I didn't know that. Okay, I don't think anybody knew that.
But anyways,
okay.
I was there for other reasons. For one thing, Carl Bernstein used to come in there every day. Almost every other day.
Hmm.
And I was the manager of the bookstore, and irritated with him because...
Is he gay or no?
I'm sorry?
Is Carl Bernstein gay?
Is he gay?
Mm.
No, but he's a freak. I had to go into the back room constantly after he would spend about 2 or 3 minutes masturbating and having to clean up his semen off the movie machines.
Oh, man.
He would also buy whips and paddles, and he would buy child pornography stuff. He would also buy S&M type of materials. He particularly liked one movie that I recall that Big Black Studs Love White Women. His favorite movie. I understand that he was invited to different porno social clubs that Buster Riggin had. He never talked to me, even though he was introduced to me by Buster, and Buster knew, because it was all out in the papers as to who I was, but he didn't seem to be concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
So all this time that you were an informant, you were still working in this store?
Bookshop?
Yes, I was.
Bookshop, yeah.
Ceased being an informant, even as of today. I only resigned being an informant only a couple weeks ago.
Oh.
It was because I was working here in New York City with the Narcotics and the Intelligence Division of the NYPD.
Well, how did you become the fugitive and then get back involved as an informant?
Because I refused to take an assignment on Marion Barry, who was also a personal friend of the mayor.
The mayor of Washington?
And Carl told me that he wanted to get rid of him because they said that they didn't want any niggers holding office in Washington, and they wanted him out of office, that he was controlling the nation's capital.
Carl Bernstein told you this?
No.
Carl Schoffler.
Oh, Schoffler, I'm sorry. Yeah.
And so, anyways, yes, the FBI attempted to come to me to try to get my cooperation on the same thing. At the time, which is another different story, take another hour, is I was the head of an organization called the Young Dillingers, which was over 2,000 or 3,000 young black kids, all ex-offenders from the court. And I can simply say the Young Dillingers were similar to the Guardian Angels, but perhaps a little bit more militant.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of calling the police on someone, if someone robbed a little old lady down the street, they would kick their ass and then call the ambulance and then call the police, and in that order. And the same thing with a rape or anything else, any type of crime, a serious aggressive crime, that's the way the Young Dillingers held it. Out of 2,000 some Young Dillingers, we had 0 recidivist rate back to the court. But the police, FBI, and Crossroads came to me trying to get me to send Marion Barry up, telling me that he was involved in cocaine. I simply refused, and then a 21-count indictment came down on me, accusing me of false pretenses that I stole over $250,000 from a lady who was my godmother and another lady who was a very good friend of mine. This was all untrue. But I was arrested, I was held in jail, and I was forced to accept a 3-count plea to the indictments because they said that if I lost the trial, the old story goes that then I would have been sitting in prison for the next 500 years.
Mm-hmm.
I should have been sitting in prison for the next 5,000 years for all the crimes that I committed for the police and the FBI and Secret Service and the whole group. But,
before I let you go, I just want to ask you this. Now, how many informants do you think there are right now? I mean, in all the movements, all the peace movements and the Tea Party movements and every movement, there's got to be a bajillion FBI guys and informants within these groups. Would you admit that, or?
I agree to that, except for one thing. That
what?
I'm called informants, that are called undercover agents. Not that many civilian type of informants, because they have trained their own people to infiltrate these groups and organizations. These are where the rookies in the academies, special ones, are trained for specifically that they profile for this type of work.
Well, like somebody like, for instance, somebody like Glenn Beck, okay, who, this guy came from nowhere, and all of a sudden, leading crowds, thousands and hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, the guy is obviously, there's somebody's backing him bigger than, he's got Murdoch, of course, but I mean, nobody's touching this guy. All right, except a couple numbnuts on the liberal end, saying, "Oh, this guy's psycho," and so on and so forth. But all you're developing here, it looks like this guy has some major backers and some major things happening.
So maybe he doesn't need any informant.
No, but I mean, there's got to be. The way I see it is, big people, these things like the media and whatnot, drag people into these big rallies or into these things, and then all of a sudden, then other people come in and say, "Hey, let's do this and let's do that. Let's throw them." They throw rocks at cops and so on and so forth, just as provocateurs, and just like you did, and so on. So, I mean, this happens quite often. Would you say that most of those people that do that kind of thing are paid informants, or
absolutely,
yeah, they're all.
I think that every large religious institution, whether it's Christian, whether it's Jewish, whether it's Islamic, they all, of course, have informants in those groups. I mean, the Southern Baptist Convention is one of the main ones that have informants in them. They consider them to be a threat to our government.
That was
one of the organizations I had infiltrated.
I remember the Quakers were infiltrated, too, in a big way. Back in 2003 or so.
Wait, which organization?
The Quakers.
Yes, well, the Quakers was on my target list as well.
They were.
And it was back in 1972.
Mm.
Well, let's bring Doug into the conversation.
Yeah.
Doug, are you there? Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I wanted to know how you got together with Mr. Merritt, with Robert, and decided to write a book. I mean, you obviously come from very different backgrounds, and you obviously were aware that he was told to hurt you. So how did you come about to write a book with him?
Yeah, really. How did this collaboration begin?
I first heard of Robert Merritt when I read the Advocate newspaper, which was a gay newspaper, in 1977. That's the first time I read his name or heard about him, in which he disclosed in an interview that I had been a target of his and the FBI and the Washington police during the Watergate case. This was all news to me. And then years passed, and it was only 2 years ago when he contacted me out of the blue and said that he wanted to tell his story. And would I be interested in writing? I've written 5 other books, and so he thought maybe I could help him on this one.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was the original attorney involved in the case, he thought that I would understand the implications of what he had to relate. And so that's how it came to pass. I mean, there was a long period there between my reading about him in 1977 and actually our having our first phone call or conversation 2 years ago in preparation for this book.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you, I know Mr. Roberts right on the phone there, how genuine do you really believe he is?
I can't hear.
How genuine, Lila just asked, how genuine did you believe he was and is? And since he just came.
He approaches cautiously, but everything eventually panned out. For example, I asked him at the very beginning, I said, we've got to get any documents that the National Archives, the U.S. National Archives, have on you. And he proceeded to get those, and they verified everything he had told me right down to the dot. We got three interviews that he gave to the Watergate Special Prosecutor,
mm-hmm.
and one that Carl Schroffer gave, and they supported everything he had said.
Mm-hmm.
He had tried to tell everything he is telling you right now in 1973 to the Senate Watergate Committee, which he testified before, and the Special Prosecutor. The Senate Watergate Committee staff member warned him that if he told everything he knew, he would be sent to jail. It was someone who didn't want the full story to come out. and a special prosecutor who was going to tell Archibald Cox.
Yeah.
But the very next day, Archibald Cox was fired as the special prosecutor. If you remember the Saturday Night Massacre.
Right.
Yeah, I do.
Robert got scared and backed off again. But he had a very fine attorney named David Isabel with Covenant and Burling in Washington all during that period. And David Isabel advised him that we want to get a grant of immunity for you so that if you do tell what you know, you won't be prosecuted. That's, you know, many times it's the whistleblower who ends up going to jail and all the other people do not, you know, the bad guys.
That's right.
And so he had a very good lawyer, but they refused to give him immunity. And so in 1973, both the Senate Watergate Committee and a special prosecutor, and he had to wait until Carl Schaffler passed away in 1996 before he felt that he was free to tell what he knew without being being killed, basically.
But he was, but now he just gave up being a, he just quit his job 2 weeks ago.
As a confidential informant, he
said. Right, so he was worse, he was still working, or I don't know, hey, Robert, you're still there, so I can ask you
as
well.
Yes, may I explain that, please?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I never did answer your question. I never did really answer. I'd like to answer it now.
Sure, please do, yeah.
I spent a couple months in D.C. jail when I was indicted.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They had another trumped-up charge on the obstruction of justice, which was a bunch of BS. But anyways, the purpose in doing so was to put me in a cell next to Jonathan Pollard, the Israeli spy.
Oh.
Jonathan Pollard and I were the only two whites out of 555 inmates being held in the jail. And Jonathan, of course, was Jewish. I didn't know that I was Jewish until years later when I got married in 2003. My wife found a book that belonged to my great-grandmother proved I was Jewish. I also, the irony to this whole story is, and in my book it states that I am the great-great-grandson of slave masters, but I'm also the great-grandson of slaves.
My
father turned out to be black.
Your father was black?
Yes, I didn't know that until I was 27 years old when I went home to my mother's funeral. I had found love letters and stuff in an envelope that she had told me not to ever open until she had died. When I was, I just want to include also too, when I was at home for my mother's funeral, I was, like I said, I was very disappointed, becoming very dismayed, distraught with the FBI and the other law enforcement. And I thought it was time for me to collect some type of evidence because nobody ever knew that I ever existed if they wanted to remove me from the face of the earth like they did with later Rita Reed.
That's right.
And so I had friends of mine to photograph me and the agents, this FBI agents, meeting at the Smithsonian, ironically, in the elephant room with the elephant in the background. People jokingly said, does that elephant stand for something? But it was not the Republicans who were the perpetrators in this story. It was just the opposite. There was a strange twist to this whole thing. And I feel that the President of the United States, Richard Nixon, was set up. I mean, I feel that he was guilty of nothing except for the cover-up. I think if he had kept his mouth shut regarding the cover-up, he would have been president, carried out his term. I think that because I knew 2 weeks in advance and that Carl Schaffner was a police detective, informed the FBI, the CIA, and military intelligence that the break-in was going to happen 2 weeks after I gave him information, that he allowed that break-in to happen, and he sat back and waited to claim the fame and the glory from it.
But that was...
The burglars themselves were entrapped and set up.
But that was now something else there that I read by... I read in Dubs' article.
I just want to hurry...
That he stated... Yeah, I'm sorry. That he just stated that was allowed to happen because a Feltz, I believe it was. Was it Feltz or somebody... Who the second guy up?
Well, Mark Felt was involved in it, but I'll let Doug explain it. But I just want to say this, and I'm finished. And that is that when I went on the run, it was at the suggestion of Carl Schaffler, and I went to New York City, and I became involved in one assignment after another, one starting with an international assignment. The man who was a North Vietnamese communist who came to our country, he owns five major hotels here in New York City, and then I ended up staying at a place. I lived in Mole City for over a year or so, which is five stories underground beneath Grand Central Terminal, a world that people don't know that exists. And these were people, some of the people actually wore suits and ties, cleaned up in the Grand Central Terminal bathrooms, and literally worked on Wall Street. They were people who were trying to save money to afford an apartment here in New York City. And to my knowledge, Mole City still exists today. But back then, it was a real mole city. No one who was allowed in there to use drugs or drink or carried weapons. But I just want to say, during these 18 years, I was on the run. After leaving Washington, D.C., I worked for the New York Police, the FBI, the Assistant United States for the United States Attorney's Office, and for a number of agencies, right under their nose. They had no idea that I was a federal fugitive because I was stabbed through my heart. And the bottom part of my heart was sliced, so apparently I didn't die. But anyways, to make a long story short, I became crack addicted for a while after that to kill the pain. And I didn't know that the person who suggested using crack to kill the pain didn't tell me that it was going to be an addiction that would last for a couple of years behind that. But to make a long story short, when I was arrested one time for possession of crack, I was fingerprinted, and they could not print me because my fingers were burned from the crack pipe. So they calibrated the prints on this new fingerprint machine, and I had given them an alias name, alias date of birth, social security number, and I managed to keep that identity because the police were dumb enough to calibrate my prints. And so, therefore, I worked 18 years for all of these agencies as their informant.
My God.
And I was also a federal fugitive. It was not until year 2000, in fact, on my birthday, June 22nd, year 2000, that I was apprehended, and that's because they started checking the welfare rolls in New York City for federal fugitive, and I was on the welfare rolls under my real name. But when I was sent back to Washington, D.C., I was sent back under the most heaviest guard. You would think I was a terrorist or something. And I went before Judge Reggie Walton, and out in the courtroom, they had four U.S. Marshals standing there with actually Uzis in their hands and cleared the courtroom while I was there to be arraigned before Judge Walton. Walton seemed to be rather amused by this, and he released me on my own recognizance to go back to New York City and to return to court, which I did, and the government totally and completely dismissed all the charges against me. When I returned, I did work off and on until a few weeks ago as a narcotics informant and with many other areas of crime, only because I wanted to combat those people who put me on, who addicted me to crack. I wanted to go after the crack dealers. It was sort of like a vendetta. That was my reason, but that's been terminated a couple weeks ago.
So did you get a pension out of all this, or a government pension?
No, I'm living off of that now. It's a great retirement. I can collect cans out of the trash can and maybe live off of their pension.
Well, I hope we can get to get that book, people to buy that book. I wanted to ask, Doug, how do you reconcile now with the kind of crap that, I mean, you have been everything from a John Birch, member of the John Birch Society, to now you're a progressive liberal.
I've never been a member of the John Birch Society.
You weren't.
American for Freedom.
Buckley, and then several members of the board of directors were members of the John Birch Society.
Oh, okay, that's right. I misread that. I'm sorry. But now you were, but I know that you were a Rockefeller, not a Rockefeller, a Goldwater supporter back, and you were young. You were a member of the on his campaign. Or
Youth for Goldwater.
Youth for Goldwater, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of your fascinating background here that you've had politically, but I just have to ask you, I mean, how, after you went through all that, you know that this what Robert was capable of, or who he was, to put together that collaboration now to write this book is quite a testament to your ability to work well. I don't know. It's quite a testament to your spirit to write this book. And I mean, I'm sure I saw that Contel Pro had a campaign out to discredit you. discredit the book, discredit Robert, you know, recently. So how are you combating that, and how are things looking for you now as far as the as with this book, with, you know, getting out? And
Brian Day is the publisher, and
right.
the book will come out as an e-book in mid-September.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to order Watergate Exposed.
Yep.
Yeah, they can make a pre-order right now by calling Prime Day.
Okay.
Phone number, 1-800 phone number is 1-800-556-2012.
Mm-hmm.
1-800-556-2012. And the name of the book is Watergate Exposed.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to that read. And
I was the first person pulled before the grand jury, even though I was the attorney for the defendants.
Mm.
I was handed a subpoena while I was in the courthouse on June 28th, which was the same day that the Robert was approached to assassinate me, and pulled before the grand jury. And I had five attorneys advising me afterwards, and I refused to answer 38 questions, and I was held in contempt of court by Judge Sirica, who at that time accused me of being a principal in the crime, in the commission of the crime. That's what he said in open court. Mr. Caddy is a principal in this crime.
Hmm.
And, of course, eventually, as it worked out, I was never indicted, named an indicted co-conspirator, never disciplined by the bar, or even interviewed by the Watergate, the Senate Watergate Committee.
Now, was he trying to intimidate you to spill knowledge that you had from your clients? Is that what his objective was?
The objective was to force me to answer 38 questions which have implicated my clients. And,
mm-hmm.
for example, one of the questions was, at what time of the night did you receive a phone call from Howard Hunt?
Mm-hmm.
And had I disclosed it, he called me 35 minutes after the arrest took place. Obviously, it would have implicated him in the crime. And we took the position that there was an attorney-client privilege,
right.
and the Sixth Amendment to the right of counsel applied.
Mm-hmm.
But Judge Sirica said no, and the Court of Appeals, who were homophobic people too, don't forget, at this point, Robert Merritt and Detective Schaffer had spread the word all over Capitol Hill with phone calls that I was a gay person.
Mm-hmm.
So they were trying to undermine my credibility and destroy my...
Yeah, of course. So how did you overcome that? I mean, how were you able to overcome that?
And of course, remembering that 1972, these were very different times than they are today.
Yeah, we were in a...
Bolshoi was still a reign of terror for anybody who was gay.
Right,
mm-hmm.
right. And I wanted to ask you, because I know that you wrote about it, and I did check out a number of articles that you wrote there on Google and on your own bio. But I was curious as to, you know, you had indicated, you had said that that Lyndon Johnson, something like in 84, Caddy, or it says in 84, you became a lawyer for Billy Sewell's Estes, and on August 9th, Caddy wrote to Stephen Trott, U.S. Department of Justice, in a letter, Caddy claimed that Estes, Lyndon B. Johnson, Mack Wallace, and Cliff Carter had been involved in the murders of Henry Marshall, George Pudlick, Harold Orr, the list is endless here, and JFK. And he added that it's willing to testify that LBJ ordered these killings and that he transmitted his orders through Cliff Carter to Mack Wallace, who executed the murders. And now you were involved with that. How did that turn out? I mean, we never heard anything about that for sure in the mainstream. Or anywhere, as to as to that story.
That Lyndon Johnson was involved in it.
Was involved with it, yeah.
Yeah, he was one of his closest associates, and at the time of the Kennedy assassination, there were any number of investigations going on that were going to nail LBJ for corruption. Don't forget about the Bobby Baker scandal. Remember Bobby Baker?
Right. Yeah, I do remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Listen, Life magazine was, I had scheduled a major publication of a magazine that was going to come out just 2 days, as it worked out, it would come out 2 days after the assassination. It was going to pull out the whole plug on LBJ, but they canceled that when the assassination took place. I left Washington, D.C. and moved to Texas, and Bill Solestis was in prison. He called, I was working for the Moody Foundation, administering grants, a very large foundation here in Texas, and he called one of the trustees and said, I want to tell everything I know about LBJ, and will the Moody Foundation give me a grant so I can write a book about it? And so that's how
the trustee of the Moody Foundation asked me to visit with Billy Solestis in federal prison, which I did, and I said, if you want to write the book, I'm told by the Moody Foundation they will give you a grant and you can write your book and tell what you do. But, and he was able to do that, but he said, first, we've got to get some immunity because of all these crimes that I was involved in,
mm-hmm.
he was involved in or connected with, I should say, connected
right.
to,
right.
allegedly connected to. And that's why I went to Stephen Trott and had this correspondence with Stephen Trott, who was the Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division in the Justice
okay.
Department at the time.
Now you represented.
Solestis backed out at the very last second. Three FBI agents flew to Abilene, Texas. I was there, and we met with Billy Solestis, or I did, and the agents were upstairs waiting to come down. And at the very last moment, Billy Solestis backed out and refused to tell what he knew.
But why do you think he backed out?
He backed out, according to a U.S. Marshal, Kent Peoples, who had been on the case for 25 years as a Texas Ranger originally, because he thought that a family member was somehow involved in the shenanigans that preceded the assassination, all the corruption that went on. And I will say this also, in the book that we're publishing, we published the oral tape given by Howard Hunt on his deathbed,
wow.
in which he implicates LBJ and names six officers of the CIA who were acting under LBJ's direction in the assassination of JFK.
Really?
This can be listened to, by the way, on the Internet. If you just Google Howard Hunt, you'll find his audio tape recording of his testament, you might say, on his deathbed, in which he identifies the officers in the CIA and LBJ as being behind the assassination. Howard Hunt, of course, being in Watergate,
right.
approached to participate in it, but he refused to do so.
Well, I have to say that both you, Douglas, and Robert have had very interesting, convoluted lives. And it's amazing that the two of you got together to write this book. And I know I'm looking forward to it. It sounds like a remarkable read. You know, but what's the really sad part, Douglas, is that I don't think that these are isolated events. I think similar kinds of events are still going on today. And what's really sad is it takes 40 or 50 years before we find out really what the truth is.
And may I address that, please?
Sure.
Sure, please.
You know, when I was informed by Detective Carl Schaffler and by people in the police intelligence of Washington, D.C., and the FBI, is that my assignment basically was against not only those who were on the political left, but even to the extreme right, but they were also against blacks, gays, Jews, and specifically any white American who would dare to speak out against our government or the establishment.
God, they must love me. Oh, man.
Whole point.
No, still even now.
Tea Party and with other things, which frankly I personally support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the people who are speaking out, especially during this particular presidency,
mm-hmm.
you know, they must be millions and millions of fouls. And I encourage any write and get your Freedom of Information file from the FBI because I'm sure it's there.
Freedom of Information file from the FBI. Okay.
Really, that's a fascinating thought. Well, I think both of you are very brave to come out and write this book.
Very much so.
But I'm really sorry it took so long for you to do it, that the times made it impossible for you to do it probably before now. But it does take a lot of courage to write about these things and correct our history that was revised. And I think it's really important.
And I have to ask you guys back on again, possibly in the near future, very near future, because the book's coming out. So
I truly hope your book is a bestseller, and I hope it propels people to think about the events that are happening now.
I do too.
And not to take everything at face value.
And Doug and Robert, we thank you for being on. We got to close down here for we got another guest coming up, but we want to thank you so much for being on and telling your story. And we want everybody to go to that to Trine Day Publishing,
mm-hmm.
and that 800 number. And also, is there a website? Do you guys have a Doug, you have a website, don't you?
Actually, the one to go to would be Trine Day's website, which is
okay.
www.trineday.com.
Okay.
Okay.
And anybody can go to check out Douglas Caddy, C-A-D-D-Y, and you see all the amazing things he's been involved with. And we thank you for coming on.
And we wish you the very best.
And thank you for allowing the truth to finally be told.
Well, all right. Thank you for telling it.
You too. And good night, guys.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Well, they have remarkable stories.
Yeah.
Each of them are remarkable people.
Amazing. Well, yeah, I mean, they're amazing people. I wanted to, we blew the whole, I forgot to get time. I was involved with this.
Would you please give the station ID?
It's a little late.
We'll give it anyway.
This is WQQQ 103.3 FM in Sharon Lake, Fort Millerton. You're listening to the LA Stu Show, and if you just caught that interview, we'll be replaying the entire interview on our blogtalkradio.com show. All right. I wanted to, that was the entire interview, and that was pre-recorded from last night, Q103's program. But, I want to thank those guys for being on, and I know some people who are listening to it tonight, you can tell your friends about it. It's going to be on in the archives with this show, and everybody can go to it. I wanted to just mention an article I wanted to read. We still got about 10 minutes left for the program, and there's an article that I think is quite relevant to this, but it's something that's happening with the Obama government, and we're seeing it more and more and more so, and we brought this up with the Kagan, nomination, and Kagan, to the Supreme Court, when Kagan actually argued against freedom of speech and argued against for the government, okay, for the Obama government, and she was the solicitor for them, and she and these things were I mean, she felt that this is an argument against conspiracy websites and things that weren't government speak, in other words, things that didn't agree with the government story. So, and it should be censored, and should be censored from the internet, censored from radio shows, censored from television, censored from everything. And thankfully, through the wisdom of the court, they thought she was out of her mind. Unfortunately, now they're plagued with her being on the court. But I was very dead set against that nomination. But here is another article that's recent. It's actually published August 30th on PrisonPlanet.com. It's a great site by Steve Watson and Alex Jones. But I want to talk about this. The government think tank calls for infiltrating conspiracy websites. Common Purpose, a Marxist front group, Demos, says state needs to fight back against people who question the authorities to increase trust in government. Government think tank calls for infiltrating conspiracy websites. In other words, one of these is InfoWars and Prison Planet is under attack for telling the truth. Furious that state involvement in major terror attacks is being exposed to a wider audience than ever before via the internet, a UK think tank closely affiliated with the Downing Street has called for authorities to infiltrate conspiracy websites in an effort to increase trust in the government. A Demos report published today, The Power of Unreason, argues that secrecy surrounding the investigation of events such as 9/11 New York attacks and the 7/7 bombings in London merely adds weight to unsubstantiated claims that they were inside jobs. This was reported by the London Independent. In other words, the fact that the overwhelming amount of evidence indicates that both 7/7 and 9/11 were inside jobs of one form or another, and that huge numbers of people are now aware of this via the increasing influence of the Internet, is hampering efforts to commit more acts of terror. Therefore, the government needs to change its strategy. In the report, Demos recommends the government fight back by infiltrating Internet sites to dispute these theories. One of the tools Demos already employs to fight back against conspiracy theories is by labeling anyone who challenges the government's official story as an extremist or a terrorist recruiter. The strategy mirrors that advocated by White House information czar Cass Sunstein, who in a 2008 white paper similarly called for conspiracy websites to be infiltrated and undermined in order to dilute their influence. In the same report, Sunstein also called for taxing conspiracy theories, any viewpoint that differs with the official version, and outright banning free speech that the authorities disapprove of. Amazing. The Demos and Sunstein are essentially calling for his classic provocateur-style infiltration, updated for the 21st century, that came to the fore during the Contalpro years, an FBI program from 1956 to 1971 that was focused around disrupting, marginalizing, and neutralizing political dissidents, often using illegal methods. And this is what Robert Merritt was involved with in those types of programs. The fact that governments on both sides of the pond have been caught over and over again, habitually lying about everything under the sun, a compliant corporate media that has aided authorities in covering up these misdeeds, has prompted a complete collapse in trust from the people, an effect that is now seriously hampering the state's efforts to enlist implied consent, with millions of people rebelling against the system through civil disobedience and noncompliance in a myriad of different ways. That's why Demos, a mouthpiece for British authorities, is desperate to infiltrate conspiracy websites, i.e. groups of people who broadcast the truth, in order to increase trust in a government that has lost all credibility. Government think tank calls for, as we have documented, governments all over the world, most notably the U.S. and Israel, already employ teams of agents whose sole job revolves around infiltrating and subverting websites that publish the truth about government corruption and atrocities. Demos is a front for the insidious Common Purpose Network, a group that Lieutenant Commander Brian Gerrish has exposed as playing a fundamental role in the advancement of Britain's role in the New World Order. And Julia Middletown, Chief Executive of Common Purpose, sits on Demos' advisory council. Demos was founded in 1993 by Marxists Martin Jacques and Jeff Mulgan, and was seen as being closely affiliated with Tony Blair's Labour government. Mulgan, went on to work inside Downing Street in 1997. This article called Current British Prime Minister David Cameron also works closely with Demos, which is the Marxist group, and has given speeches at the group's events. Demos has routinely acted as a platform for elitists who wish to drastically alter society, eliminate freedoms, and sacrifice British sovereignty in pursuit of global government, just like the Council on Foreign Relations here in the United States do the same thing. On August 9, 2006, British Home Secretary Dr. John Reid, another former Marxist, gave a speech at Demos Conference stating that Britons may have to modify their notion of freedom, claiming that freedom is misused and abused by terrorists. Yeah, right. Demos is partnered with numerous other globalist organizations, from government and industry, including IBM, the Carnegie United Kingdom Trust, and Shell International. The organization's logo includes all-seeing eye within its design. Although the group poses as an independent think tank, Demos is little more than a public relations firm for the British government and security services. Its effort to demonize conspiracy theories in order to increase trust in the government is a transparent ploy to do the bidding of its masters by demonizing anyone who challenges a corrupt, lying state and its nefarious activities as an extremist and potential domestic terrorist, contributing to the chilling process which seeks to crush free speech on the Internet. And with that article, you can go to that article on prisonplanet.com. And the show has ended. We just stopped streaming. But I want to thank our guests, Doug Caddy and Robert Merritt, for speaking with us. And I hope you enjoyed the show. And don't forget, they're coming after us. Robert Merritt can attest to that. The government is everywhere. I'm sure they're listening to this program tonight. So I want to thank you and talk to you tomorrow night. And tomorrow, I believe we're going to have Maria Fix Algeri with us, a psychic and friend. And we'll be discussing many, many things she's a fascinating, fascinating woman. So I hope you join us. And we will be taking call-ins for Maria as well. Everyone's welcome to join us. So good night.